My name is Bill Erbrock. I'm in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. And tonight we're doing the third in a series I've entitled Suffering Under the Shadow, a series that is taking some hints from a book by Phyllis Trible, Texts of Terror, Literary Feminist Readings of Biblical Narratives. By the way, if some of you would like to buy this book, I saw about a half a dozen copies are still available in the bookstore. And I also want to remind you, you know, that all the sessions that everyone does here are taped, so if some of you really find sessions you like a lot, the tapes are usually ready within 24 hours already for purchase. During the first session this week, we talked about some images of God suffering, not only in the scriptures, but that we see in the world around us and in our own lives. Yesterday, we looked at the story of Hagar, the Egyptian servant or slave of Sarah and then of Abraham, and saw that usually she's overlooked in the scriptural story, an oppressed person. And Phyllis Trible, in her book here, sort of held this forgotten woman up for us to review her story and to try and pique our own awareness again of people who are simply forgotten in our own world. Tonight we're looking at another woman that seems to me gets very little press usually. There's really not a lot said about her story, and it is, I think, truly a terrifying story. It really is a text of terror. It's the story of Tamar. Some people say Tamar, but I think most Jewish people prefer to pronounce it Tamar, so I'm going to call her Tamar this evening. The brother of Amnon. There's another Tamar also in the Bible elsewhere, so you have to remember who this one is. The sister of Amnon, right? And also the sister of Absalom, because there's a problem here of full and half brotherhood and sisterhood because of common father David and different mothers. Trible, in her second chapter in Text of Terror, characterizes Tamar as a princess to whom belong wisdom, courage, and unrelieved suffering. And I'm going to do the same thing tonight that I did yesterday with Hagar, and that is, I want to review for you, first of all, how Trible looks at the literary design of the story, the overall design of the story, the episodes, and then we'll come back and zero in on some particular motifs and reversals and some key words and other devices that sort of heighten what's going on, and then finally conclude with some responses, because that's one thing that Phyllis Trible always does. You know, how has the story been responded to? And if it's a story that's been generally forgotten, what might be some appropriate responses for us nowadays? Trible divides this story into seven episodes, three on each side of a central climactic episode. There are three episodes before the crime itself, and then three episodes after the crime. And she then gives you letters also to let you know that the three episodes after the crime tend to pick up and reflect what happened in the three episodes before the crime. Not in exactly the same order, but in doing so, you have an overall sort of a ring composition. And one thing that those of you who've been in these classes with me also last week, there are several here who were, you will have noticed how carefully Trible is able to see this in so many of the compositions of these ancient Israelite compositions, that they like to do this. You say something at the beginning, you reach towards sort of a central climactic point, and then somehow you pick up what you said. Those of you who've been doing the Psalms classes with Dick Meyer, he's been pointing to something not exactly the same, but similar in some of the parallelism in smaller units within the Psalms. The first segment, her first segment, what she calls her A segment, is the introduction of the characters and circumstances in the first three verses. Absalom, David's son. And if you read her text, she always has a much more careful translation, because she always does it very stodgily according to the Hebrew, and it makes things shine a little bit better. But since we have RSV, we'll read that. Now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. And Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Yonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, and Yonadab was a very crafty man. This little introductory episode gives you the characters and the circumstances. They're all there in a couple of brief sentences. Something that Phyllis Tribble points out, I think rather nicely, is that the sister, Tamar, is ringed about also by her brothers. If you look at the first sentence in verse 1, you see there's Absalom, David's son, on the one side. There's Amnon, David's son, on the other side. And there's Tamar in the middle, who is the full sister of Absalom. And obviously only a half-sister to Amnon. The other person who's introduced here is Yonadav, who is a cousin in the family, and of course, by implication, King David, who kind of hovers back behind the scene. So all the principles have been introduced. The second brief episode is in the next couple of verses, as the action begins. Amnon is sick with desire here, and it's the section in which Yonadav and Amnon make their little plot, right? So Yonadav says to Amnon, "O son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? Will you not tell me?" Amnon said to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." Yonadab said to him, "Lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Let my sister Tamar come and give me bread to eat and prepare the food in my sight that I may see it and eat it from her hand.'" Interesting little twist that Tribble points out, and that is that when Amnon was introduced, we were told that he was making himself sick with desire. And when Jonadab gives him advice, he says, "Pretend that you're sick in a different way," although he already is sick in a certain way. And in some ways, the entire story is a sick story. So there are all kinds of little persuaders that kind of set us up for something awful that's about to happen, with the mention of illness on sort of two levels. The C episode, the third episode, is the one in verses 6 through the beginning of verse 9, David and his children. "So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill, and when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, 'Please let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight, some pita bread or whatever, that I may eat from her hand.' Then David sent home to Tamar, saying, 'Go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him.' So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, where he was lying down, and she took dough and kneaded it and made some cakes in his sight and baked the cakes. And she took the pan and emptied it out before him, but he refused to eat." And then we come to the climactic scene, which would be the D scene. It's a climactic scene. And being the climactic scene, it's also the fullest scene. And it is itself developed in a ring pattern, so that you have circles within circles. And Tribble says she gets the impression as she's reading this story that the circular motion here is to give you a sense of the entrapment of Tamar. Everything conspires to encircle her and snare her, to trap her, even the way the writer chose to compose the story. The central scene includes the last part of verse 9 and runs all the way through verse 18. Amnon first gives a command to his servants, and they respond. Then he gives a command to Tamar, and she responds. Then there's a conversation between Amnon and Tamar, and climactically, the rape itself. Then, mirroring the other direction, there's a conversation again between Amnon and Tamar, another command of Amnon to Tamar with her response, and another command of Amnon to a servant, plus a response. And those of you who have Tribble's book will have delighted in the way that she patterns that out on page 44. It's very nice, and it's clear to see that. Amnon said, "Send out everyone from me." So everyone went out from him. That's the command to the servant. Servants in response. Then he said to Tamar, command to Tamar, her response, "Bring the food into the chamber that I may eat from your hand." And Tamar took the cakes she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon, her brother. But when she brought them near to him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, "Come, lie with me, my sister." Here's your conversation between the two. She answered him, "No, my brother, do not force me. Such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this wanton folly. As for me, where could I carry my shame? As for you, you would be as one of the wanton fools in Israel. Therefore, speak to the king. He will not withhold me from you." But he would not listen to her. And then, very quickly, comes the awful deed itself. Being stronger than she, he forced her, and it says in Hebrew, he laid her. Doesn't say with. Stronger than that. Then he hated her with very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love desire with which he had love desired her. And now comes the mirror conversation between the two. He says to her, "Get up and go." But she said to him, "No, brother." She had said no's before. "For this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other which you did to me." But he would not listen to her. And so another command to a servant. He called the young man who served him and said, "Put this one out of my presence," and shut the door after her. The RSV says, "Put this woman," but in Hebrew it doesn't have woman, it just says this one. "Put this one out of my presence. Shut the door after her." So much for that central climactic episode. Now we have three episodes after the crime. Mirroring the Yonadav Amnon conversation in the first part, now we have an Absalom Tamar conversation. See, there was counsel, was crafty, evil counsel between Yonadav and Amnon at the beginning. Now we have counsel of Absalom to his sister, and in his case, it's sympathetic counsel. So this would be your B prime. See, it reflects that B section. She was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for thus were the virgin daughters of the king clad of old. So servants put her out and bolted the door after her. Sorry. And she put ashes on her head and rent the long robe which she wore and laid her hand on her head and went away, weeping as she went. And her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon your brother been with you? Now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Don't take this to heart." So Tamar dwelt a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. Now you have another mention of King David. So this would reflect the mention of King David in the first part. This is your C prime. When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. And you have a concluding final verse, which again sums up the characters and the circumstances. But Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar And there's a rather striking thing that Tribble says. If you look at the first verse and look at the last verse, in the first verse, Tamar was caught in the middle. You weren't sure if she was caught or what. Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, desired her. Absalom here, Tamar in the middle, Amnon over there. In the last verse, she's been excluded. She's the last one named at the end. She's outside the circle. Although she's not completely outside the circle, because we know that Absalom wants to do something for her, but the circumstances have changed. And you have a double mention of both brothers in that final verse. Tribble, of course, does a much more careful, close reading than that, but that at least will give you some sense of the incredible artistry with which the narrator is telling a tale of terror, a horrible story. And of course, if you're able to do something like that, it already means that you've stepped back a little bit from the horror, haven't you? We had a rather funny lament sung for us three times now already today, the New Holden Lament. But if you've ever really read some of the laments in the Psalms, or if you've read the Book of Lamentations, you're surely struck with the incredible artistry of those lamentations. In order to write a lament like that, it means that the person or the community lamenting is already somewhat distanced from the pain that causes the lament. The pain is there, true, but there's some distancing. I've often suggested to some of my students that when they really hurt sometimes, some of the best therapy is to try and paint out your hurt if you're an artist, or to compose a song about your hurt if you're a songwriter, or to write something about your hurt if you can write. Because already in doing that, you begin to put some distance between your creative self that's still there and still alive and the wound that, yes, of course, you're carrying, but which has not completely destroyed you. The very fact that you can create something about it indicates you have not been destroyed. And that ability already to... Well, I don't think that Tamar wrote this. It's not her composition. But the narrator, however sympathetically the narrator may tell the story, is already somewhat removed and presents this to us in a very beautiful and artistic manner, as it were. And perhaps that, if anything, makes the story all the more awful. That you can tell such a terrible story in such an artistic manner. There's a response up top.
A question, Bill. Why... I've been thinking about is, why is this story preserved? I mean, the fighting between David's sons, I mean, that's obviously part of it, but it's preserved in such such length.
Why is the story preserved is the question. Can we save that for later?
Yeah, fine.
It's on the notes, and we'll get to it.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think the story is basically preserved because of any great feeling for Tamar.
No, I'm sure that's not true, but it's...
Any more than I think that the Hagar story we looked at yesterday was preserved because of some great sympathy for Hagar. I mean, she was just a means, as she now is in the text, right, to get us over to Sarah and Abraham and Isaac.
But of all these women, she seems to be dealt with the most sympathetically, which is hardly anything at all.
She is dealt with sympathetically, I think.
Yeah, which is interesting compared with the other ones.
Yeah, the Hagar story, you don't even... feel that the narrator felt sympathetic for her necessarily.
Yeah.
Although there was a double promise to her, and that, I mean, it's hard to say.
Yeah, but still, there seems to be more feeling and emotion. But
in this one.
That's true in Second Samuel anyway, but...
Another response.
Maybe just had a woman author. The other thing that...
The response was maybe there was a woman author. We, of course, have no way of knowing that. And in general, we've always felt that all the writers of Scripture are men. But how do we really know that?
The other things that occurred to me are the commonalities with present-day rape situations. the rapist was known to the woman, and that often is the case now. Someone counseled the rapist, you know, if you'll just wait a while, you can probably get this legitimately. But no, he didn't want it. You know, he chose not to.
Couldn't wait.
To take what he wanted when he wanted it. And the person who responded to Tamar saying, look, don't take this so seriously. You can brush this off. This is, don't make such a big deal of it.
We'll have to come back to that one, though, because that was meant sympathetically. Mm-hmm. And you'd know that if you know the following stories after this.
I think that's often our response as a helper, to comfort someone by saying, you know, you can get past this too, and this isn't going to be the end of the world,
uh-huh.
even at the time where the person it happened to, the victim, feels that it is the end of the world. And in some way, there's a side of that that negates the importance to the person as the victim.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Maybe we can think of something else to say to a victim that would be more helpful.
Yes, the question is how the response was, how appropriate is this hold your peace and don't say anything about it, that everything will work out, you know, at that particular moment. Well, that's the general design of the story as Phyllis Tribble outlines it. There have been some other people who've worked on this story recently, and those of you who have the book, I really recommend her footnotes to you. These footnotes are just a mine of information. And among other things, she points to at least three other authors who've recently worked with this and who more or less come up with the same division of the story as she does, but not exactly the same. Let's go beyond now the general design of the story and look at some of the thematic motifs and some of the reversals. The major motif that Phyllis Tribble points out, and I think it's extremely helpful, and that's why she entitles her chapter, Tamar, the Royal Rape of Wisdom, is that through this chapter, you have a very strong motif of folly and wisdom. And some of you were in the Psalms class this morning and you dealt with a psalm about that. Who are the representatives of folly in the story? There are basically two. Obviously, Amnon.
And
Yonadab. And it's made a little bit more, you know, grating in the sense of Yonadab, because he obviously acts in the story like a counselor, doesn't he? He's a cousin in the family, but the story says he's hakam. He's wise. The overtone in here, of course, being that he's wise, he's craftily wise. He can sort of trim the sails to the situation. After all, he's only a cousin in the family. Amnon is the king's son, and Amnon is in line for the throne also.
Well,
if you know the context around it, he's the son in line for the throne at this point. So, of course, if Yonadab sees that Amnon wants something, it certainly is to his advantage to ingratiate himself to him. So when he finds out what the problem is, he says, well, let's just work this out for you. You know, you are, after all, the crown prince.
And maybe he'll get some too.
Well, who knows?
You know.
Who knows?
He was related too.
So a person here who is supposed to be a wise counselor ends up being a crafty counselor. He is not using his wisdom in the service of good, he's using his wisdom in the service of evil, and therefore he is a fool. In the scriptures, in the Old Testament scriptures, folly is very often equated with evil. Wisdom is generally equated with good. And so there are always, when you talk about wisdom or folly, it also has these sort of ethical or moral overtones or undertones, however you like to image that for yourself, but that sort of shoots through there. So Amnon obviously is the largest representative of folly, of foolhardiness, because of course little does he realize at this point that he's going to get what he wants. He does get what he wants, but an aftermath of the story down the line is that there's going to be revenge taken, and he never is going to get the throne that he's in line for. But if these two men Amnon and his counseling cousin Yonadab are the representatives of folly. Who are the representatives of wisdom in the story?
Absalom and Tamar.
Yes, and Absalom and Tamar, and especially among those two, Tamar, of course. She is the real representative of wisdom in the story. And she comes with these cautionary no's, right, on three occasions. No, no, before, and no, after. And when my wife Barbara and I, heard Phyllis Tribble present this chapter orally at a meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature last year, and I remember how forcefully Phyllis Tribble presented this part where she said, "Isn't it amazing the way that this woman responds to what happens to her?" She doesn't go into hysterics. She's in a situation fraught with danger, and she responds with incredible rationality. She doesn't fit the misogynist stereotype that says, well, when women get put in a situation like this, they're just going to go right into hysterics. Well, she doesn't go into hysterics at all. And when he first says to her in verse 11, "Come lie with me, my sister," she says, "No, my brother, don't force me. Such a thing is not done in Israel. Don't do this foolishness." And then she even gives a reason. "As for me, where could I carry my shame? As for you, you'd look like one of the worst fools in Israel." And then she even goes a step further. And says, if it really has to be, make a request of the king. He'll let you have me. But of course, he wouldn't listen to her. And after the deed was done, again, he says to her, "Get up and go." She doesn't start blubbering hysterically. Once again, very rationally, she says her, you know, trying to wake him up. She says, "No, my brother." She still calls him brother even. "This wrong in sending me away is greater than the other which you did to me." But he wouldn't listen to her. And it's only after she has been put out that she allows herself what any human being, I should think, would allow him or herself in that situation, to go into mourning for herself, weeping and crying aloud. You know, what an amazing woman. She is the voice of wisdom here, and she is the voice of wisdom that has not been heeded. She's wisdom violated. Well, of course, if you know, one of the major themes in Scripture is that rulers are supposed to rule with wisdom. And of course, he's a future ruler. And instead of ruling with wisdom, he has violated wisdom. Now, that's a rather marvelous thing because, and this is now some of my own comments rather than Phyllis Tribble's, although she hints at this towards the end of her chapter. You're certainly aware of the fact that wisdom, in some passages in Scripture, including Proverbs and elsewhere, is lauded as the first creation of God. There's a very famous section in Proverbs where wisdom speaks even. Lady Wisdom speaks. And she says, "I was the first of the divine creations, and I was there at the beginning when things were being created. And the Creator delighted in me because, as it were, I helped the Creator." You know, it's the wisdom of God becomes personified or hypostasized, as it were. And of course, in later Christian tradition, the idea of wisdom gets taken over in a double way. In one way, it becomes subsumed under the teaching of the logos, the rationale of creation, chapter 1 in John, where the logos is what's with God at the beginning. It was read by Rudy last night during our Vespers service. He talked about the divine energy. And that becomes identified with the Christ, but wisdom also becomes identified with the Holy Spirit. And many of the older Christian texts identify the Spirit of God as being a feminine principle. Because the word for wisdom in Greek is Sophia, which is a feminine word. Just as Chachma, the word for wisdom in Hebrew, is a feminine word. Hence, the wisdom that was with God at the beginning is, as it were, the co-creating feminine principle. Now, you see how this sort of lifts up Tamar, if you make some of these connections. She, as it were, becomes wisdom personified here. I mean, it isn't only Tamar who's violated. It is the divine creative energy that's violated by a skewed sort of energy on the part of Amnon, and a skewed and twisted sort of counsel and wisdom on the part of Yonadab. And that's why, in my opinion at least, Tamar is a worthy representative of God suffering. And evidently she also is in the mind of Phyllis Tribble, because at the beginning of her chapter, Tribble has this beautiful memorial stone. It says, Tamar, princess of Judah, a woman of sorrows and acquainted with grief. She picks out one of those suffering servant verses from 2 Isaiah and applies it, I think, rather aptly here to Tamar. That's a very powerful motif, the motif of wisdom. And Amnon comes out the fool, and Tamar is wisdom, ignored and violated. Another powerful set of motifs that run through here are the family motifs. You know, the two brothers are the ones that kind of encircle Tamar here. One encircling for evil, and Absalom comes out pretty good, doesn't he? He comes out at least being her protector and doing the best that he can to make things right. In fact, Tribble says of him, oh, I lost it now. Well, maybe I'll find it again some other time. She has a nice thing to say about him. Oh, he's the advocate of Tamar, she calls him, Absalom. But perhaps more striking than that, you know, we know this rivalry because it's the full and the half sisterhood brotherhood. But what about the relationship to David in the story? Here's something that I had never noticed in all the years that I've read this story. And again, I need to just say a thank you for Tribble. She is so fine at looking at these things. Never in the story, she points out, do you have father-daughter language. She never calls him father. She always says the king. The narrator never says she's the princess or the king's daughter. You have to get that by implication. Well, if she's a sister to two of the princes, oh yeah, she must be the king's daughter. And if it says that she's wearing the kind of a robe that virgin princesses used to wear in those days, oh, well, then she must be herself a princess. David goes to visit Amnon when he's supposedly ill, and he is ill on another level. Does he go to visit Tamar? No, he sends her a message in verse 7. He sends a message to her. Does he say, go, my daughter? No, he says, go. You see? Afterwards, when he gets upset at the end, his response. See, what is he upset about in verse 21? When King David heard about all these things, he was very upset. He was very angry. About what? is the question. And Tribble has pointed out that in some of the other translations, it makes it very clear what he was so upset about. If you have page 53, one of the manuscripts in the Dead Sea community at Qumran, the community dating from about the time of Jesus, says, "The king was very angry, for he loved him because he was his firstborn son." That's what upset him, that Amnon had done this, and of course then probably revenge would come on Amnon, and the crown prince would then lose his place. That's what he was upset about. And the old Greek translation, which was used by the Hebrew community in Alexandria, makes it plain too. It says, "And David did not rebuke Amnon, his son, because he loved him, since he was his firstborn." So the rabbis and the biblical translators of this tradition who lived around the time of Jesus figured out why David was angry. It wasn't because he was upset because his daughter's virginity had been violated. That was irrelevant. What upset him was that his firstborn son had gotten into trouble. How am I going to get him out of this, you see? That's what upset him. Does that sound like a familiar response? You know, that many fathers have nowadays when their sons are caught doing something. You don't get angry because of what happened to the girl. You get angry because, how am I going to cover up for my son?
Isn't that true of the Hebrew mind of that time and the Hebrew thinking of that time? The sons were worthy, the daughters were unworthy.
Yes, and I think Tribble is trying to say, and it's not only been reflective of the Hebrew mind of that time. It's reflective of a mindset that's been fairly widespread in all sorts of cultures in all sorts of times. And therefore, when you come 1,000 years after the deed, and the rabbis at about the time of Jesus are preparing their translations, they take the ambiguity out because they understand it very clearly. Oh, of course, that's what he got upset about. And if that's so, then that doesn't say very much for the wisdom of David either. So that implied is a condemnation of David as well, who also does not listen to the voice of wisdom, but follows in the path of folly. Well, coming back to a question that Nancy asked before, you see, if you put this into the larger context, this chapter about Tamar and Amnon is a part of the larger, what we call the court history of David, or the history of the throne succession in David's family. It begins in 2 Samuel 9 and runs over with a couple of breaks at the end of 2 Samuel into the first chapter of Kings. And it's the story that begins with this crucial episode in which David, who had never ever done anything wrong in all the stories ever told about him, now having become king, commits about 4 sins out of 10 of the commandments, all at one swell swoop, as it were. He sees the lovely Bathsheba, and so, you know, he wants her. So that's the coveting. He takes her, there's stealing. He commits adultery with her, and then he has her husband murdered. That's 4 out of 10 commandments. I mean, that's pretty good for a person who had never ever sinned before, according to all the other episodes. And you see in the story, how does this chapter then serve? It serves as poetic justice on David. David committed adultery, murdered. Now within his family, one of his sons commits rape, incest. The other son, in revenge, those of you who know the sequel of the story, has him murdered a couple years later. And so within the larger story, this serves as poetic justice on King David for his sins. And whatever sympathy we have for Tamar is taken up into the larger story. Here's a lesson, you see. This is how God is punishing King David, by letting that happen to Tamar and letting that happen to Amnon. And then we're all supposed to be satisfied that justice has been served here. It's like that story, you know, when when the first child is born too, of the adulterous union between David and Bathsheba, the child dies. That's how God punishes David, making the child die. But then, since David is sorry, he gets a substitute son instead, who happens to be Solomon, and is the one that eventually is going to get the throne at the end of this story, but we never hear about him until then. It's a very nice device, again, of keeping you on tenterhooks until you finally get there. Well, not many good things to say about Tamar in her family. And do you also notice how in several places it doesn't say that she spoke? It'll say Absalom said, Amnon said, but it'll say she said. You don't use her name. A little hint about her place in all of this. And this is supposed to be wisdom. Wisdom becomes almost anonymous here in the story because there are deaf ears to her on all sides. How about a couple of key words that are used in the story to move on from major motifs to some more minor ones? One of them, of course, is, or two of them, are this wonderful pair that's used, right? The pair for love and for hate. And Tribble shows that in this story, the word for love, the root is ahav or ahav in Hebrew, really doesn't mean what we understand by love. It really means lust, lustful desire. And you have this striking balancing in the story, because there are four times in the story where it says he desired her, and then as soon as he gets what he desired, you have this incredible statement in verse 15. Then he hated her with great hatred. The hatred with which he hated her was a lot more than the desire with which he desired her. That's right, it's 4-2 within the sentence even. The very way that the sentence is constructed. And finally, hate breeds hate, because at the end of the story it says, verse 22, and now Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. So hate wins out by a score of 5-4 over lust, love. Another powerful word that's used in here is the word for lie down, shakav or shakev in Hebrew. It's used in verses 5, 6, 8, 11, and 14. So that as you're moving up towards the violation, the narrator is setting you up for it with these hints, right? He's been told to lie down in his bed and feign illness. When she comes into the room, she sees him lying there, looking ill. But of course, this supposedly weak, ill person lying there is the one who's going to grab her and force her and lay her. And the text is very brutal at that point. So you build that up, and you put that awful word, hazak, grab hold of. Beware of this lying dog. Another one that Tribble really works with is the combination of the making of the food and the sight of his eyes, right? And it's even more so in Hebrew. Some of our English translation has taken that out. He cannot do to her what's in his eyes, it says at the beginning. And then he wants her to come in so he can see her while she's making this food. And then, of course, he ends up ravishing her both with his eyes and eating her, as it were. I mean, these are very heavily sexual kinds of overtones, as you well know in a lot of literature, right? We even have that in a lot of our crude jokes. Right? All these jokes about eating. They're sexual jokes. And here she is, in all her innocence, baking this nice little pita bread for him, or whatever it is that she's making, very nicely in his presence. And he is already devouring her with his eyes. Because it all has to be done in his presence. She can't even cook it out elsewhere, right? It's got to be done here, right here while I'm watching this. And it's a very powerful motif. And you know he's going to gobble her up. He's already ravished her with his eyes. This always reminds me of a scene that's the opposite. And that's that wonderful scene in the movie Tom Jones from Fielding's novel, you know, where he and this woman that really desire each other have this meal where they're just piling that food in their mouth. You remember that scene? It's one of the most erotic scenes I've ever seen, and I absolutely love it. But you feel good in that scene because they're both into it and they both want it. You know, they're equal. And it's very much like the Song of Songs. Those of us who did Song of Songs last week, that also abounds in this food imagery. All these wonderful fruits and things that they want to eat. But they both want to do it. There's an equality. There really is some love and some sharing in those stories. Here, it's all one way. There's one in here who is the glutton. And there's one who is being devoured. Finally, Tribble shows how very powerfully the word go works in this story. She says of this word, when it first appears in verse 7, Tribble says on page 50, go, the word that altered her life forever. David says to her in verse 7, go to your brother. In verse 8, it says, so she went to her brother, Amnon. In verse 13, she says, where could I go if you do this to me? When it's all over, in verse 15, he says, get up and go. And finally, when you come to verse 19, twice it says, Tamar put ashes on her head. She tore the long robe which she wore. She laid her hand on her head, and she went weeping aloud as she went. And so this word go, with all these commands, you see, encircle her. The men command her, but the place that they sent her was not a very good place for her. It's a place of desolation and a place of weeping. Well, there are several other devices that are used here too, and those of you who have the book, look for it. There's at least one mitigating factor in this story. We don't always have mitigating factors. And that is, maybe two, we might say, although the first one is a horrible mitigating factor. If you read the rest of this chapter, verses 20 and the following, you know that sometime later, Absalom works out a plot to get Amnon away from the safety of the capital city and has him murdered. So he gets his revenge for his sister in that horrible way. But there's another lovely notice in chapter 14 of 2 Samuel, which is a more poignant mitigation of the story. It says in chapter 14, 25, in all of Israel there was no one so much to be praised for his beauty as Absalom. Same word that had been used of Tamar's beauty. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. When he used to cut the hair of his head, because he would cut it once every year, it weighed 200 shekels by the king's weight. There were born to Absalom 3 sons and a daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. And notice, in this one, the 3 sons are not named. The daughter is named, and this niece is named for her aunt Tamar, and she carries the beauty. There is at least some slight mitigation here. And here at least is a woman who had been violated, where not everybody responded and said, well, now you're spoiled. At least the full brother names the niece after her to carry that name. But of course, Tamar herself left the scene weeping. We're out of time, but I wonder if you have a couple of responses yet to the story. when Tribble ends this story, she ends practically in silence herself. She says, and we, what do we do with this story? And just kind of leaves it there. You get a sense of devastation when she comes to the end. Anybody want to say something? We had a break up for Vespers. Tomorrow we're going to do the story in Judges about the rape of the Levite's concubine. So it's another horror story. If you want to read it ahead, it's in Judges chapter 19. Thank you, people.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.